I want to return to some of the issues raised this morning, and I think the, as we've seen to some extent, the Hall effect can address a number of the questions that were already posited. And I want to take a quick run through talking about quantum phase transitions, and also at the end a little bit about fluctuations in domains, because it turns out, at least to my surprise, that the Hall effect is very good at actually being sensitive to these sorts of effects. I'm going to start with not back to 1879 with Hall, but back considerably at the beginning of the high TC game to remind you about some of the attention being paid to the Hall effect in that case. Just so you don't think that that phenomenology is restricted to reduced dimensionality systems, I want to talk about the Mott-Hubbard transition in a three-dimensional, purely three-dimensional system, which is the prototype for the Mott-Hubbard transition, vanadium sesquioxide, and its relationship to this sort of phenomenology you see in the high TCs. And then finally, spend most of my time talking about spin density, wave order, and chromium. The approach to the quantum critical point in chromium was led by Minet Lee, and the more recent work now in domain wall motion by another one of my students, Rafael Jaramillo. So you know this data. This is data taken from Ong. There's quite a bit in the literature. This is IPCO dealt with zinc. This is the longitudinal resistivity with the famous linear T. This is 1 over the Hall coefficient, so basically the number density. You see a number of things here as a function of doping with zinc. One is the fact that there's strong temperature dependence, usually associated with a pseudo gap. I'd like you to remember what this looks like because chromium looks exactly the same. Also, here, of course, there's a 1 over x scaling with the concentration. What Ong did was to plot the cotangent of the Hall angle, which is a combination of this data in the form of sigma xx over sigma xy. The reason for doing this was that, of course, the transport time comes out from sigma xx. Sigma xy is a function of both the transport scattering times and the Hall time. So if you take this ratio, you get something related only to the Hall time. And the suggestion was made by Anderson in the context, of course, of spinons and holons, but perhaps more generally in the notion of relation to spin and charge, that the interesting thing here is that the transport here goes as linearly with temperature, while the Hall goes as T squared. And Katrine mentioned this morning, of course, similar phenomenology in seeing the heavy fermion materials. You may not be quite as familiar, but you can see the same thing actually near Mott-Hubbard system and vanadium sesquioxide. V2O3, its precursor, is an antiferromagnetic state, which then if you dope by putting in vanadium vacancies, you can drive away from half-filling into a metal. This is data now, which is also the cotangent of the Hall angle. It's an antiferromagnetic insulator to antiferromagnetic metal transition, so this upturn here has to do with the spin density wave in the metal. As you look now at the comparison between the resistivity, the longitudinal resistivity, and the Hall resistivity, you see similar discrepancies. The tau transport, the resistivity just goes as T to the 3/2. This is the Maria spin fluctuation type explanation. While the Hall angle here goes as T squared, and what's particularly nice is as you go well away now, as you dope well away from half filling, well away from the Mott-Hubbard transition, you see strong deviations from this T squared behavior. And in fact, you can approach a T to the 3/2 behavior as you dope far enough away, at which point you no longer have a discrepancy between the transport time and the Hall time.
Question?
Yeah.
One of the significant things about the Ong experiment was the T symbol behavior is equivalent, and showing that then really make it look like
in
lifetime.
Right. We don't have enough systematics to do that in that fashion, unfortunately. What you do see in the specific heat, though, is a divergence of the M star of the transition. But that's the main thing you get out of it.
No
Well, chromium goes in the opposite direction. It makes it more insulating. Titanium, you can do it. The difficulty is what we found was that the titanium gave you inhomogeneous material. And so we relied on being able to use thin platelets in annealed in different oxygen atmospheres because that gave us uniform material. So I can't answer that. I want to talk mostly, though, about the spin density wave in chromium. To remind you, chromium's a 3D transition metal, cubic. It's an elemental antiferromagnet where you have a spin density wave ground state of 311 K. It has this nice nesting behavior, although this is an idealization. These are much more complicated, of course. It's an incommensurate Q vector. And you can drive this Nael temperature, which starts at 311 K, by either doping with vanadium or by applying pressure. And I'll show you data taken from both sorts of approaches. This is an overview. This is now being cut off very nicely, but this is the Nael, no, I guess it's okay. This is the Nael temperature as a function of vanadium concentration. The critical concentration is about 3.5%. As you get very close, and I'll show you data later, this bends over with the true critical behavior. The magnetic moment, which is reduced to start with and is driven to zero, there have been no measurements down here. I would take a neutron experiment. What I want to emphasize here is this is the inverse Hall coefficient in the zero temperature limit. So basically the carriers per unit cell, you see roughly one number here, and then at the transition you get a doubling of the Hall coefficient. So the Hall coefficient is very sensitive to the quantum critical point where TNAL is going to zero. You see similar behavior in the magnetic susceptibility. This is a much harder measurement. And note that it's a much smaller effect. You're going from basically 5 parts and 320 over here, which of course is because the Fermi surface, the magnetic susceptibility, is seeing lots of different effects across the Fermi surface. So you have the Hall coefficient jumping. You can ask a couple of questions. One is, does a longitudinal resistivity see the quantum critical point? In a lot of these sorts of systems, of course, you see non-Fermi liquid behavior as given, at least in one case, in a number of cases, by linear dependence of the linear temperature dependence of the resistivity. And you can ask, is this a discontinuity, of course, or is it continuous? That's come up before. We've done some pressure measurements to answer this. This is Manet's Lee's work. This is an overview here. This is resistivity on this axis, temperature and pressure. So now you've taken lots of data to get this surface here. As you reduce temperature in the low pressure limit where you still have the antiferromagnetic state, you see the minimum that's associated now with the opening of the spin density wave gap. That is suppressed with pressure. A critical pressure of 7.5 kilobars kills the Nael transition. This is now in a sample that's already doped with vanadium, so its bare TC is not 300 Kelvin, but 52 Kelvin. So we can get reduced pressures that way. Pure chromium has never been pushed through. We're trying now with a diamond anvil cell. Probably takes about 15 GPa, 150 kilobars. So you see the suppression, and you can ask now, what about the temperature dependence in the paramagnetic phase up here and through here? And what you see, in fact, is no evidence that the longitudinal resistivity sees much of anything. It seems to be T cubed, which is just phonons in a magnetic state, through here. Pardon me?
Why don't you plot it here?
It's a symmetry argument. You get a T cubed times a T squared. So this is, you see a T cubed because of that. So, right, that's right, and you don't have the T squared because of the lack of the symmetry of the scattering. So this is seen in lots of antiferromagnets. That's right. Pardon me? It's through this. This is, right. So now you can ask about the temperature dependence of the Hall coefficient. I haven't shown you this to high temperatures. I've only showed 120 Kelvin. If you went up to 300 Kelvin, then this would go up to about 7 on this scale. So you see that same sort of strong temperature dependence. I wanted to highlight the fact that at the spin density wave now, the Hall coefficient changes a lot, of course, because you're seeing the opening of that gap and the change in the concentration. This jump at the transition, so now the transition is right about here, effectively 3.5%. This is well into the metal, where paramagnetic metal into the paramagnet came from this sort of change over here. But you can ask whether it's discontinuous or not. These are different concentrations of vanadium. You now can map onto this the various concentration, the various data points that you take as a function of pressure. This gives you an idea, and you can see that you start to fill in this region here with the higher resolution. And I show you the net part of that in this plot here. This is the original data I showed you, which had samples with different concentrations. We now take this sample here and we squeeze it, and you increase your resolution quite a bit. And you can see, in fact, this is a continuous transition, which is fit by an exponent of a half with this critical pressure as a set of 7.5 kilobars. So the transition is sharp, but it's continuous with an exponent of a half. You would say this is just simple mean field behavior, but in fact there are other exponents in the problem which don't follow as quickly, and you can see that from looking at the delta rho over rho, the change in resistivity due to the opening of the gap. So how this is defined is, here you have this minimum, you have the T cubed at high temperatures, so you do a 2T cube fit here, and this is delta rho. Okay, and in fact you can do self-consistency checks and see that the T cubed you get, the residual resistivity from the T cubed fit, and what you measure at low temperatures where you don't have a transition, where you don't have this minimum in the paramagnet, in fact doesn't change across this whole region, which, given that this is a pressure measurement, you don't, and the impurity concentration's fixed, you don't expect to see any change in the residual resistivity, so it gives you some faith in these fit. So then you can go and you can now look at delta rho over rho as a function of pressure. It has small amount of rounding down here, and if you take account for that, you get, in the same way as you do for the Hall data, you get a exponent of roughly 2/3 with the same critical pressure. This exponent continues, in fact, at all. If I take a bunch of isobars, this is the data you saw at half a Kelvin, I can do the same thing at a series of temperatures, and this 2/3 is robust up to as high as we can measure, get a sufficient amount of data to measure. So if it's due to quantum fluctuations or some sort of aspect, they're robust all the way up to the, well, at least up to 38 Kelvin. And let me note that there's one more exponent in the problem, which of course is the phase boundary, TNAL versus pressure, and that's also a half in this case. Yes? How do I know the pressure is independent of temperature? We measure the pressure at a variety of temperatures, yeah. This is now the last point I want to cover in the last few minutes, which is domain structure and dynamics in pure chromium. As I mentioned, there's a 311 Kelvin transition for the opening of the spin density wave in pure chromium. When you go to lower temperatures in pure chromium, there's also a spin flip transition between a transverse spin state, where the spin and the Q vector are orthogonal to each other, to a longitudinal spin state at low temperatures below 123 Kelvin, where they line up. This is suppressed by vanadium doping, so you didn't have to worry about that before. What you find is, if you look, I'm sorry, you can't see very well, this is just the Hall coefficient now, you see incredible hysteresis opening up. And as far as we can tell, nobody's reported this in the literature, although there are some Hall effect measurements on chromium. I mean, people have looked at chromium forever. But what you see is that this is a cooling curve, this is a warming curve. You see that they agree above the Néel temperature, 311 Kelvin. They agree below the spin-flip transition, but that there's this huge hysteresis loop, which has to do with the domains, presumably, in this material. And you get some evidence for that. This is unpublished data by Eric Isaacs and Paul Evans, with they are able to actually do X-ray microscopy and look at, image some of these domains. And you can see going through the spin-flip transition, one sees, in fact, different patterns as you cycle around. Here, this is 140 Kelvin on warming. This is 140 Kelvin on cooling. The white and the green have to do with different orientations of the so-called S domains. The S domains are the ones where the spin vector is perpendicular now to the Q vector.
Is there any,
What you can see from this is real space imaging with the X-rays. This is 100 micron bar, so they're roughly 50 microns. This is a macroscopic sample, I mean millimeters, okay? What we're doing next is to shave a sample down to about 50 microns and see basically one or two domains and see what they do in the transport that way. Let me note that you can do all kinds of tricks with this to get some evidence, to get some insight in what the domains are doing. If you scratch the surface of the sample, you can pin the domains and actually collapse the hysteresis loop, because now you fix them and they can't move around anymore. So you just have to use a little mechanical thing. So this is where the metallurgy and the physics actually reinforce each other. Yes?
Are there different propagation vectors of the spin density wave? You have a Q vector. So
I have a Q vector, that's correct.
But are these degenerate?
Yes, there are degeneracy. So when he's imaging, he's just picking out one of the three cubic directions. That's in fact right. So to do the full experiment when you image, you've got to look in all three directions. When we, of course, do the Hall coefficient, we're insensitive to that science. But you're absolutely right. So it's threefold degenerate because it's cubic. The other thing is if you pass the current different way, so I have some domain alignment here, rough domain alignment, and now I look at the current this way, the Hall voltage this way, or the current this way and the Hall voltage that way. In fact, I can reverse the hysteresis loop, which one is preferred. And you can see in this actually one, I have huge amounts of noise, which actually repeat on different on cycles. So this is telling me something about the domain structure.
Is this the Markov noise?
Presumably, it has to do with the domains, yes.
Can one actually get a distribution of analog sizes?
I mean, if one did a proper job rather than just showing you this curve, yes, I think so. And I think actually, you know, there's all this work on thin little wires of ferromagnets asking about domain wall tunneling. Basically, at low temperatures, one might be able to now look and talk about anti-ferromagnetic domain walls and tunneling. Things like that. So I think there's a lot of potential here. We've barely scratched the surface, if you will. So in summary, I wanted to make a number of points. One is the Hall coefficient does say something, but I don't want to get into what exactly in terms of theory, between spin and charge in the cuprates, heavy fermions, and Mott-Hubbert transitions. So I think across a broad variety of quantum critical behavior. It's certainly the most sensitive probe of the quantum critical point in chromium vanadium, both in terms of the magnitude of its jump, which is continuous in this case, and also in the strong temperature dependence above the Néel temperature. And finally, it's remarkably sensitive to microscopic structure and dynamics of the domain. So I think it gives you another avenue into looking at some of these questions of the relationship between domains of whatever sort of magnetic character and transport properties. And so I'd encourage its use. I would claim it's still underused in that fashion. Thanks.
Basic question, why do you think the Hall effect is sensitive to this domain wall motion?
Well,
the propaganda of Hall effect is it's insensitive to grains, you don't have, that's why you can use all crystalline samples.
why are we suddenly seeing this as remarkable, but what's the origin?
Well, I mean, clearly from looking at the difference between passing the current one way and passing the current this way, it must be some sort of scattering phenomenon. Why it's so sensitive to the spin density wave as opposed to just the crystallographic ones, I'm not sure. But I mean, it has magnetic.
Yep. No. We have to get an important
fashion.
Well, sir, no,
and try to control the output.
No, it's actually the hysteresis is only from the S domains, not the Q domains, because there's no hysteresis below the spin flip transition.
Okay.
So that's fine.
I have a comment in which was independent of what Paul asked, but.
Yes.
If one does a theory of transport in general,
mm-hmm.
what one will discover is that whenever you have strongly Q-dependent scattering on the Fermi surface, the rule that the Hall number is independent of temperature, the textbook thing is not correct.
Mm-hmm.
That proved that Eddie Ray Brown and I constructed in connection with the Q prints. Which brings into account Paul's question. What is relevant is that when you have strongly Q dependent scattering, then the scattering is small angle scattering, so mm-hmm. same energy. And then certainly for domain wall scattering will be small angle scattering.
Mm-hmm.
And if there is small angle scattering, the usual textbook rule for Hall effect.
Thank you.
Can we go back about five slides towards the Regis community at higher temperature exponent of oil? Yeah, that's it.
Yeah. Sorry.
On the highest temperature data, the 38 Kelvin, is the error bar at 38 Kelvin as narrow as it is for?
No. Clearly, you're right. The error bar here is a consistency check at this point. It's not a fit per se in that sense. So you don't have much data. I mean, sure, we have cuts at even higher data. So that's right. So. I would say the statement here, these are all fits. We have lots of nice data. You can clearly tell the difference between a two-thirds and a one-half. By the time you're down here, you draw a curve through it that's the same fit as the other ones and see if it's consistent, and we don't see deviations.
Well, it was
yes.
Just the thought that maybe some theorist would like to make a prediction what the exponent might do if you went so far up.
Yeah, I mean, my naive expectation was that if the fact that this was two-thirds instead of a half because you're seeing some sort of strong quantum fluctuations and not just mean field behavior, that if we went to higher temperature, we'd see a crossover to the one-half. We don't within this amount of data, and that's the limitation, see that.
A half is outside your error bar.
Certainly, for all these guys up here, this is the same curve drawn with the two-thirds, I don't know, one-half might. I mean, there's a limited amount of data at this point, right?
Just explain, why does it curve like this?
Oh, there's some inhomogeneity, which is within inhomogeneity in the X. So this is even though we're doing pressure, we're dominated by the fact that there's some concentration gradient of vanadium across the sample. And so we convolute this fit, PC minus P, with a Gaussian distribution with delta X. We use that fit with a fixed delta X then to fit all the Hall data as well. Okay, so these are the first fit to the Hall is a three parameter fit. We then fit delta X. No, I'm sorry, this is a three parameter fit. And then we fit delta X PC and there's a one parameter fit to the Hall data.
And what's X?
X is the concentration of
for
vanadium, yes, so for this sample, 3.2%. No, it's 3.22. Okay, so it's, I mean, that's the effective way. I mean, you can, Okay, so how, it's an effective thing. I mean, what you can do is you can map, I mean, so how this comes is you can take all the data you can find in the literature, which is taken by people that have done either different concentrations or different pressures. You can then get a relationship between pressure and concentration by trying to collapse all the data on top of each other, which is actually an interesting point that you can do that because it suggests disorder is not the dominant mode here. And from that, then you can, any gradients in the pressure or the fixed inhomogeneity we take as an effective delta x. So that's how we go through that process. Yeah?
I want to take a chance to focus here and just ask you about resistivity.
Yes.
Do you regard that resistivity, the excess resistivity, delta rho, as being
yes.
a change in the phonon mediated resistance?
Well, since we subtract off the TQ,
yes.
the argument is that comes from the actual opening of the gap. And I would say in V203, we've done two experiments. We've done the neutrons and measured directly the magnetization of the spin density wave in the metal. And we've also done the resistivity in the same fashion, and the two agree completely in terms of the critical behavior. Okay? So they map right on top of each other. And so I would always kid Gabe and say, why do you bother doing neutrons? I can just measure the resistivity, right? But we've not done the neutron experiment here. So I would expect that the magnetization, that we're basically measuring the magnetization. That's what
so
delta rho for all
is.
That's, but it's not been checked.
In V203, the paramagnetic phase used to have T-square resistivity. Old V203 in the paramagnetic.
Yeah, and Dennis didn't even see the antiferromagnetic state.
Sorry?
He didn't see the antiferromagnet. He missed it. So
you're saying that the T-square in the...
T to 3 halves.
In the paramagnetic phase, you have T-square resistivity in V203.
In V203, we see T to the 3 halves.
Oh,
all the way in the, yes, way in the paramagnet, yeah, but the antiferromagnet goes quite a long way.
So you're saying the old measurement of McLaughlin, the T-square, is not correct. Is that right?
Tom would jump in.
I'm saying,
in relation to your question,
the chromium.
No. Do I need to be more precise about my measurement, my answer on chromium? I was trying to address your answer on chromium. I think that it, the delta rho over rho, my expectation is the magnetization will show the same behavior. That is true by analogy, which is the basis form of argument, by, I think Samuel Johnson said. But in V203, but we've not done the neutron experiment on chromium. We tried actually in December, but the helium clamp cell gave out at 5 kilobars.
I want to go back to the question.
You said there was a jump in the Paul constant. And then you said the jump was continuous.
No, it's continuous. If you look as a, I tried to make that point. I'm sorry if I was unclear. Is it eight? Yeah. That is, if you look at this region here. I mean, if you just take a series of samples, it looks like a jump. And then I pose the question, is it really if you could do a high-resolution experiment? So what looks like a jump here is, in fact, under high resolution, a continuous transition given by an exponent of a half.
Could it be that there's a narrow region where you have different physics than a broader region where you actually have a jump?
right. I mean, this is the highest resolution we're able to do. It has a small amount of smearing, but small on this scale of effective percentage. It looks continuous on this scale. Yeah.
Well, I mean, do you have a simple picture as to where this
step, what the whole effect should actually change. I mean, this morning, you know, there was a little bit about construction on the steam engine, but improving
well, Mike Norman has done the calculation of just folding up basically the spin density wave, and he predicts then an exponent of a half for this. What doesn't come out of that picture is a different exponent for delta rho over rho, and a strong temperature dependence then, which may come from the Q dependence of the scattering or whatever. My inclination is that, and let me just call it inclination, is that just the folding up of the simple spin density wave is not enough to account for this, and the different exponents are suggestive to me, at least, as a simple experimentalist, that, you know, different regions of the Fermi surface contributing in different fashions, somewhat akin to the high TCs. But, I mean, I've tried to be clear showing you just the data, and you can use it to draw your conclusions.
So with that ongoing calculation, do you put in the density of states effect on the scattering? I mean, so the resistivity seems to be the only thing that doesn't look mean field like. And you might say, well, the change in the Fermi surface and the density, got Fermi golden rule calculation for scattering of changing the density of final states as you open the gap. So it may not depend quite as mean field like on the gap.
You may know Piers better. I don't know exactly what he puts in that calculation.
Sorry.
I mean, I would like to believe you the proper golden rule.
Right.
Calculation.
Right. Of course, I mean, as a function, I've shown you that as a function of the pressure through this region, the residual resistivity doesn't change experimentally. This is the residual resistivity basically going through this transition, right? And so as a function of doping, of course, the residual resistivity changes.
That's assuming that's subtracting a particular plus a constant.
Right. This is rho naught. This is this here. This is this fit from the high temperature data. And then this is the actual measurement in the paramagnet. So that's correct. The underlying resistivity, you're doing a pressure measurement, so you don't expect the residual resistivity to do anything. It's a much cleaner experiment than taking a series of samples, each of which has its own disorder. I'm sorry, that wasn't the point you're making, I'm sorry. Right. This system's clean enough that you should be able to do that. We have not done that. Right. I would too, actually. That's right. I mean, it's a good suggestion. Oh, yeah. I mean, chromium's known very well, and there have been neutrons, and they're huge spin fluctuations. And all. I'm afraid I don't know. I mean, people have worked on chromium for a long time, so there probably is something in the literature.
Yeah, variables can apply to current and science, which are actually in the domain, like the point.
We've not measured magnetization. Sorry. Right. I mean, what we were planning on doing next, besides looking at a small sample which only had one domain wall in it, was to actually do the X-ray imaging and look at the domains, see what they did. But the magnetization might be useful as well.
Any last questions? Okay, that's it for today. Do you talk?